This is an ABC podcast.
I'm looking out at a beautiful seascape. The sky is a dazzling light blue. The aquamarine ocean is flicked with bright white waves and glistening yellow reflections of the sun. And nearby, there are bottle brush trees covered in rich red flowers. If you were standing next to me, can I be sure that you're experiencing the same thing as me?
The answer is no. What you're referring to is the idea of experience being private. Let's say two people are looking at some scene or something and they're describing it to each other and it seems like they're experiencing the same thing. Well, it turns out that we know that they perhaps are experiencing maybe about the same thing, but we have no way of knowing exactly what they are experiencing. There's a term that philosophers use called qualia. Qualia is the essence of an experience. So if you're having a red qualia, then that is the essence of what redness is to you. Let me give you an example to illustrate this idea of the private mind. Let's say that there's two people standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon. They're looking out and they're marveling at how wonderful it looks and they're pointing out things to each other and it seems like they're getting about the same experience. All of a sudden, something called the experience fairy comes along, just bear with me on this, and taps them on the shoulder and all of a sudden their experiences switch. So now you're having the experience of your friend and your friend is having your experience and amazingly enough, they're not exactly the same. The reds look a little redder perhaps than they did when you were looking at it. The far end of the canyon looks a little further away. There are subtle differences. That's what we mean by qualia. Each person's qualia is their own private experience.
Hi, it's All in the Mind on RN. I'm Lynn Malcolm. In this episode, a broad-ranging exploration of the mind-brain connection and how it creates our conscious and unconscious experience. With me is Bruce Goldstein, Emeritus Professor in Psychology at the University of Pittsburgh. His recently released book is called The Mind, Consciousness, Prediction and the Brain.
The mind and the brain are intimately connected because the brain creates the mind. However, there's a big difference between them. It's often been said that the brain is something that's material. You can take a picture of the brain. It can be photographed. But you can't take a picture of the mind. The mind is invisible. And so that's led to a lot of arguments. There are some people who actually say that they're two totally different things. But most respectable neuropsychologists say that the mind depends on the brain, and most research is trying to make links between the mind and the brain.
And we'll hear later from Bruce Goldstein that he sees the brain as a predictive machine, which has a predictive power that's key to our survival. But first, let's go back for a moment to the idea we started on. How does our mind and brain create our unique experience of the world around us? Bruce Goldstein told me about an experiment that tried to demonstrate this. It involved studying the brain activity of a boy in a coma named Sam.
Yes, Sam is one of these people. There are many people who are in comas, staring out into space, they're kept alive by life support, and it doesn't seem as if there's anyone in there. So in this experiment, Sam was shown a film, which was excerpts from an Alfred Hitchcock movie, in which this little boy gets a hold of a real gun and goes around pointing it at people and threatening to shoot them, and there actually are bullets in the gun. Well, there are places in this film where there's very, very high tension because of the drama that's going on. And then there's other places where there's not that much tension. They put Sam in a scanner, in a brain scanner, and measured his brain activity as he was watching the film. And what happened was that during the places where there was high tension, his brain activity would go wild. And during the other times, it wouldn't. And then they did the same thing for people who were not in a coma, and they had the same pattern. So Sam was reacting in the same way as people who weren't in a coma. So there must be someone in there. There's just no way to know. But this is a really good example of the idea of a private mind. You would think Sam would be totally not there, but he actually was, although we have no way of knowing exactly what he was experiencing.
So how does the nervous system, or our physiology, if you like, create experience?
That's the $10,000 question. I can tell you that we don't exactly know, but let me try to give you an idea of how people are thinking about that. One way to think about it is the idea of looking at what kind of signals are going on in the nervous system that are causing our experience. And when you do that, what you're looking at is nerve impulses in neurons. And when you look at the neurons, you see that what nerve impulses are sodium and potassium ions moving across membranes. So what you're talking about is a chemical process. So basically, the answer to the question is that there's a chemical process that somehow causes us to have experience. And then the question is, how in the world would ions moving across a membrane result in experience? As it turns out, no one can answer this question. For good reason, this has been called the hard problem of consciousness. And the reason it's called the hard problem is because no one can figure out how to solve it. And in fact, people aren't even trying to solve it because it's so hard. They're looking at the relation between the brain and experience in a different way. What people do, instead of researching the hard problem, they research what is sort of tongue-in-cheek called the easy problem. And the reason they call it the easy problem is because it's easier than the hard problem, but it's still pretty hard.
And what is that easy problem? Researchers are studying the neural networks of the brain to understand the physiology of experience. Bruce Goldstein likens this to the way traffic moves through a city.
You have the highway system, and at various times of day, the highway might be, for example, lots of traffic going into town in the morning, and then later on, traffic going out of town, or traffic going to a sporting event. So the activity in the road system is constantly changing. The same thing happens in the brain, but we're talking about nerve networks rather than a road system. And depending on how you're thinking, depending on your state of consciousness, whether you're sleepy or not, it changes the activity in this brain network.
We've known for many years that different areas of the brain are specialized for different functions. But it's emerging in research that this idea, referred to as localization of function, is oversimplified.
The idea that a particular function was represented in a particular area of the brain. So one of the examples is faces. When people look at faces, there's a certain area called the fusiform face area, and that has a lot of activity. And that is true. So there's nothing wrong with that. The problem is that when you actually look at the bigger picture, there's activity in a wide scattered area of the brain, what we call networks. So the fusiform face area is connected to many other areas of the brain. When you look at a face, many different things happen. You recognize the face. You read an emotion into the face. You might have other kinds of reactions to the face. These all activate different areas of the brain and parts of the network. So we're getting back to this idea of a network with a traffic pattern in it. And depending on how you're reacting, let's say you look at a face and the face is an angry face and you get afraid. All of a sudden, the activity in the network is going to like start going over towards the fear area of the brain and so on. So basically, the present-day thinking about understanding the brain and experience is that we're not talking about single areas. We're talking about networks, and they often extend over huge areas of the brain, from the front to the back, from side to side, when you see these pictures of networks. Also, another way to look at it is, let's say you're trying to solve a problem. You have certain networks that are involved in thinking. But as you're solving the problem, the activity goes to different parts of the brain as you think of different aspects of the problem. So again, it's changing across time.
And Bruce Goldstein explains that most of what we experience happens outside of our conscious awareness.
We're aware of our experience, okay? but we are not very aware of what's going on behind the scenes in the brain that causes that experience. The classic example of that is seeing. You just open your eyes and you see. It becomes hard if it's, let's say it's a foggy day, there's not that much light, but most of the time you just open your eyes and you see. What's so complicated about that? Well, it turns out it's so complicated that people have been working on it for over 100 years and they still haven't figured it out completely. There's a lot of processes that go on in the eye, in the brain, that are happening in millisecond time scales that go on without our awareness, and yet then all of a sudden we see. One of my favorite vision examples is what you do when you look out at a scene and you are moving your eyes from one place to another. Typically, when you look at a scene, you're moving your eyes two or three times a second from one place to another so you can see different parts of the scene. Now, if you were to peer into the person's eye who's doing that, you would see that there's little images on the back of the eye. And every time they move their eyes, the image smears across the retina on the back of the eye, which makes sense because the eye is moving. But we don't see the smear. And why don't we see the smear? Because there's a signal being sent down to the brain that is telling the perception area, watch out, the eye's about to move. Don't be fooled, okay? Just keep the scene steady. This is an example of behind-the-scenes activity that's keeping the scene steady. We don't see it smear every time we move our eyes.
You're with All in the Mind on RN. I'm Lynn Malcolm, and I'm with Bruce Goldstein, Emeritus Professor of Psychology at the University of Pittsburgh. In his recent book, The Mind, Consciousness, Prediction and the Brain, he highlights our amazing capacity to make predictions about the future. Behind the scenes, our brain is often making predictions in the areas of vision, language, music, memory, and social interaction. And this predictive power is essential to our survival.
It is one of the hottest topics in psychology today. It's really started 20 or 30 years ago, and people came up with the idea of called prediction error. And what that means is that we are constantly making predictions about things as we are going through our lives. Let me give you an example. Let's say you're just taking a walk in the woods, and you've done this many times before, and you sort of know what the sounds are like in the woods and so on. All of a sudden, you hear this strange sound coming from the right. It's almost like there's something running through the woods, and you stop, you look, and you find out perhaps it's an animal coming towards you or something like that. Okay, so what happened there is you're going along, your predictions are fine as you're walking along, and then all of a sudden something happens that is an error. It violates what your prediction is, and you have to take it into account. We are doing this all the time. Anytime we have something that happens that is not what we expect, then you've generated a prediction error. And then you have to take action to correct it and to make the prediction error go away. It's a very adaptive way of behaving. So the idea is that this prediction error actually comes from the brain. It's from what's going on in the brain. We have expectations, and we're always testing what's going on against our expectations. There are many mathematical models that try to explain how it works. No one really knows how it works.
All right, so let's just go through some of the ways in which the brain is a prediction machine, as you say. An example is when we read. We're making a lot of predictions when we read.
Well, every time you're reading anything, let's say you're reading, John put on his bathing suit and decided to, well, you know that it's going to have something to do with jumping into the water or going to the beach or whatever. You're having a conversation with someone. You very often can predict what the next thing is they're going to say. And if they say something surprising, all of a sudden, well, that's a prediction error. And you have to like sort of take it into account. You know, it's been said that people who have lived together for long periods of time, they almost know what someone's going to say before they say it. And so there's a lot of predictability in language, both in conversation and in written language.
And so when we read, is there something physiological happening that contributes to this prediction around what's going to come next, say, in a sentence?
Yeah, there is. The brain is always thinking ahead and making predictions. And I can give you an example of a physiological experiment. It measured a response called the event-related potential. For example, they would tell someone, here's a sentence. There was a nice breeze, so the girl went outside to fly A. Okay, so what do you think that's going to be after A? Well, probably kite. Okay, that would be the predictable response. When you have a predictable response, the event-related potential stays a pretty low energy. There's not a lot of activity. There's not a big response. But if the sentence went like this, there was a nice breeze, so the girl went outside to fly Anne. And now all of a sudden, what would Anne be? I guess it would be an airplane or something. But that's very unexpected. And so all of a sudden, the event-related potential perks up and you get a big response. And so the message here is, and this has been shown in many different experiments, that when there is a prediction error, or if you want to use another term, just if there's something unexpected happens, the brain perks up and there's a large response. It's like a warning response almost.
Just as it does with language, the brain's predictive mechanism also influences the way we hear and experience music.
In music, we're not talking about meaning like we do in language, but we're talking about notes, about what note's going to come next. Let me try doing great moments in music here, and I'm going to sing you a song, okay? There was a little bit of a pause there, and that was a little bit disturbing probably because you wanted to hear that last note. Hearing that last note is what's called return to the tonic. It's actually the same note as the first note. And there's sort of a rule that people tend to want a melody to return to the tonic. That's prediction. Okay, they're predicting it's going to happen. Doesn't happen all the time, but it happens very, very often in music. That is an example of prediction happening in music that's been shown through many experiments. If you're measuring brain activity and the person is expecting the melody to go back to the tonic and it goes somewhere else, then you get this big burst of activity in the brain, just like I explained for the language.
And also repetition in music creates a prediction too, doesn't it? You get repetition in even the vocals in music.
Right. You know, a lot of music, there's just about all it is repetition over and over again. But if you look at classical music, there's often repeating themes over and over. The themes come back even from one movement to the next. And people are expecting that to happen. Of course, the classic example of repetition in music is Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da. And then if you keep on listening to that movement, I don't know if anyone's ever counted how many times that's repeated, but it's many, many times. And you expect that to happen, and it's just something that it really does, in many respects, add to the music because you're predicting, and it makes you feel good to be able to predict what's going to happen next.
So can we predict, for example, from our memory of the past to what might happen in the future?
That's a good question, because what seems to be the consensus now is that what memory is for is actually predicting the future. And it makes sense when you think about it. Memory is telling us, you know, how the world operates. You know, when I did this, a good result happened. When I did this, a not so good result happened. And so when you have that information, that helps us behave correctly, behave in an efficient way in the future. One of the experiments that makes a link between memory and predicting the future is an experiment where they measured brain activity in a brain scanner of a person remembering a past event. And you got activity in the frontal lobe, some activity further back. And then they asked the person, okay, why don't you think about a similar event that might be happening, say, a week or two in the future? And when people did that, they got activity in exactly the same areas, a little bit different, but mostly the same areas. So the activity of thinking about something from the past and thinking about what might be happening in the future turns out to be very similar. And interestingly enough, there are some people who have brain damage who cannot remember what happens from the past, what we call episodic memory, memory for life events from the past. And when they are asked to imagine something that might happen in the future, they can't do it. Let's say, oh, imagine going to a party next week. They have a very difficult time doing it, and they can't remember a party that they went to a week before. So there's a very close link in the brain between the memory from the past and what we're going to predict is going to happen in the future.
And how does our capacity to predict influence and impact the way we interact with other people, our social interaction?
Well, social interaction, that is perhaps the most difficult kind of prediction because you're dealing with other people. There's a term called theory of mind. And what that means is let's say you're interacting with another person, and let's say you don't know them that well, but you know them a little and you're having this interaction with them. And what you're probably doing is you're coming up with some kind of idea about what they're going to do next or what do they mean by saying that. You're trying to understand what's going on with them. And when you're trying to do that, you are creating a theory of mind about the person. You're trying to create a theory of what's going on in that person's mind. And we do this constantly, all the time, as we're interacting with people. We may not even realize we're doing it. And so we're constantly making predictions. And since people are so interesting and different and unpredictable, sometimes what we predict does not happen. And then, of course, we can get into trouble in social relationships.
Young children, especially before the age of about 4 years old, do not have the same theory of mind as most adults have. It develops through childhood. A famous experiment which demonstrates this theory of mind is called the Sally Ann task.
What you have an adult who has two dolls and they're telling a story to a child. Let's say it's a child who's like 3 years old. So the story goes something like this. Here's Sally. Sally has a box. And here's Ann. Ann has a basket. Okay, Sally has a doll in her box. And Sally decides to leave the room. So Sally goes out of the room to play. Now that Sally's out of the room, Ann takes the doll from the box and puts it into the basket. But Sally isn't there, so she doesn't see her do this. Okay, then Sally comes back into the room. And where do you think Sally is going to look for the doll? So if the child is a young child, 3 years old or less, they will most of the time say, Sally is going to look in the basket. Why will Sally look in the basket? Well, it's because the doll is in the basket. And sometimes there's some questioning, and it almost seems like the child sort of realizes that Sally wasn't in the room, so didn't see it, but that doesn't register. Okay, so they're not taking what's going on in Sally's mind into account, that she couldn't know that the doll was moved to the basket because she wasn't there. Now, if you do the same thing on a 4 or 5 year old child, it's interesting. I've seen videos of this. The adult asked the 5 year old, okay, when Sally comes back into the room, where is she going to look for the doll? And they look at the experimenter like they're crazy. Like, what do you mean, where is she going to look? She's going to look in the box. That's where it was when she left. Okay, so they know, they have a theory of Sally's mind that the 3-year-old did not have.
As adults, we also make predictions as we interact socially, and this is known as mentalizing.
Let's say you're near a hill and you see a rock rolling down the hill, okay? Well, you don't usually say, the rock wants to get to the bottom of the hill. Okay, that would be an act of mentalizing, but we don't usually give mental motivations and so on to rocks. But if you saw a person running down the hill, you might make something up. You might say, that person's running down the hill because they want to catch a bus, because you know there's a bus stop at the bottom of the hill. And then let's say that a bus turns the corner and the person starts running faster, then you say, oh, yes, I'm pretty sure the person wants to get is running down the hill in order to catch the bus. So that's an example of making up a hypothesis about what the person's doing, what's going on in their mind, why they want to go down the hill based on evidence that you see in the environment. And we're doing this all the time. Anytime someone's doing something, we're often making up some reason why they did it. If you're good at it, people with good social skills are better at mentalizing than people with poor social skills because they can tell why people are doing what they're going to do. And of course, this brings up the issue of autism, because people who are autistic have a very poor mentalizing ability. They are not very good at trying to figure out what someone is doing and why they're doing it.
What can this ability to predict teach us generally about how the mind works?
What it teaches us is that the mind is adaptive. The mind works in order so that we can survive. And the way we can survive is to be able to predict what's going to happen in the future. And if something happens that is not what we would predict, that we can take steps to deal with it. It's as simple as that, really. Now, it's very complicated when you start getting into the physiology and the psychology of it. But when you come right down to it, that's what it's all about. It's about doing what the organism needs to do to survive. And what this means is we're not just talking about people here. Animals also have do predictions and have prediction errors. Most life forms that have survival value have some kind of prediction mechanism.
What are some of the newest breakthroughs in mind and brain research which will make a significant difference to our understanding of the mind and consciousness in the years to come?
Well, there's a lot of different things that are going on. We've been talking about networks, and this is one of the big areas. It's like trying to figure out how these networks work. How does the traffic pattern change in these networks for different situations? About 2 weeks ago, they had a conference. It's usually in Tucson, Arizona, which is where I happen to be right now. It's called the Science of Consciousness. And interestingly enough, there were a number of sessions in that conference on psychedelics. So this is a big new area of research. You know, it used to be back in the 60s, of course, people who remember that, they'll remember Timothy Leary and people who were taking psychedelic drugs to expand their consciousness. Well, now what's happening is the people are taking psychedelic drugs in laboratories to expand their consciousness, but people are put in brain scanners and they're measuring their network activity and they're trying to figure out how changes in consciousness cause changes in activity in the brain. This is pretty exciting stuff. So that's one of the areas of research that is trying to figure out what's going on in the brain in different types of consciousness.
But still, it's the so-called hard problem which remains unsolved.
Remember, we called it the hard problem of consciousness. And the reason we called it the hard problem is because the hard problem is how does the mind actually cause consciousness to happen? And even if we're looking at the easy problem, which is like, what is it about different areas of the brain, how the activity occurs in different areas and how traffic patterns change for different states of mind and different tasks and different experiences, these things are still a huge mystery. A tremendous amount of progress has been made, but I think we still have a long way to go before we really understand this.
Bruce Goldstein, Emeritus Professor in Psychology at the University of Pittsburgh and author of The Mind, Consciousness, Prediction and the Brain. Thanks to producer Jane Lee and sound engineer today, Marty Peralta. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Bye till next time.